Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dance Talks. My guest today is Chris Mercer, the author of a new book called Flight of the Starling. Starling is a black bird similar to a crow, for any of you who don't know about that. It's a piece of fiction, and it's just out. I understand it's a trilogy, and the other two parts will be coming up later this year. Where did this story come from? Is any of it true?
Well, let's get right to the meat of it. Hi, Jan. How are you?
Good.
Is the story true? Do you remember Warren Adler? He wrote War of the Roses years ago. Remember? And it was about this divorced couple and how they just ruined the house and everything in their life. And I interviewed him once. And I talked to him about being a fiction writer and how I wanted to be one, but I was afraid people would see themselves and how terrifying that would be. And he said, you can't write fiction if you're not willing to upset people. So yes, in any fiction, in my opinion, there's a lot of things that are true. And already people who have read it, who know me and have spent time with me for the last 40 years in the Hamptons, they keep saying, oh, this is me, right? I'm like, whatever you want it to be. So yes, parts of it are true and parts of it are not. I mean, the premise of a billionaire's daughter being trafficked 25 years prior to his billionaireism has not specifically happened that we know of, but is it possible? Yeah, it is actually. So yes, there's lots of it's the true and there's a lot of it that's plot line.
But there's a backgammon table and a lot of backgammon in this book. What has that got to do with it?
Well, backgammon is how the billionaire and our protagonist Justine communicate. She always goes to the billionaire's home for the big Saturday lunches and dinners. And afterward, everybody wants to talk to him, but he takes her and they play backgammon. She's a ranked player. I do play backgammon and I have been a ranked player. But backgammon for me, there's chess and the best player will always win. And then there's backgammon where there's 40% luck and 60% skill. And on any given moment, you can lose even having done exactly the right thing. And so for me, that is why I like it better than chess because it mirrors life more. So backgammon being the backdrop of that is a way to discuss what they're thinking, but it also talks about what I consider to be the premise of backgammon. I love backgammon. Backgammon's emerging again. Do you play? Do you play, Dan?
Don't, no.
It's a great game and it's popping up again. And you're going to see in all kinds of houses on Architectural Digest and things now, you see backgammon tables once again, you know.
Well, another thing that's popping up in the book is Clara Starling from Silence of the Lambs. How does that fit into it?
Well, in my opinion, Clarice Starling, Jodie Foster, playing the role of Silence of the Lambs. Silence of the Lambs is, in my opinion, the best feminist film that's ever been made. And the way all the men in Silence of the Lambs, some of them are evil and some of them are very well-meaning, but they still get in the way because they don't really understand how women should be treated. They don't realize their own bias in there. And the way Clarice Starling handles herself is the way I wish I handled myself in the world. So our protagonist, Justine, who is dealing with these CIA agents and this powerful billionaire, and you know, she's this person who has never been a spy, never been in that kind of situation. She's like many of the women I hang out with in the Hamptons, but very smart. You know, she uses Clarice both for her courage building, but also the way Clarice handles all the men in Silence of the Lambs is the reason Jodie Foster fought for that role, by the way. I don't know how much you know about the film, but and it's taught in every film school. Jodie Foster begged, borrowed, and stole to get that role for that very reason. She felt it was such an important role for women who can learn to handle well-meaning men and then also bad men. So it's interesting.
It's also a lot of it set in the Hamptons.
Well, the Hamptons in Palm Beach, and I've spent 40 years in the Hamptons and many years in Palm Beach, and a lot of it's the same group of people, but I think there's a culture there that is specific, which you would know better than me, having started in being the Dan of Dan's Papers. There's a culture that's very unique. And there's also, I think, people living in the Hamptons that might have opportunities like this to go outside their wheelhouse of comfort. So yeah, a lot of it takes place. And yes, you'll recognize places you've eaten in. And also you're going to say, who is that billionaire? Because I've seen that house before. And since you read an early version years ago, I don't know if you even remember, but I'm not going to say who that is. I never will say who it is. But yes, you will recognize a lot of the people, places, and the possibility, maybe. I don't know. Maybe the possibility.
The book deals with trafficking and wealth and power, which is in the news these days. Were you writing this as a thriller, a social novel, or something else?
Interesting question. Is it possible to say both, maybe? I don't know. Look, when I started writing this 6 years ago, Jeffrey Epstein was not the position that he's in now. Trafficking was not considered what it is now. And trafficking then, you know, most trafficking is done by women who are either bought or from lower socioeconomic groups or whatever. As things unwind and we see that trafficking can happen anywhere, anytime, I have sat on numerous boards for trafficked women for many, many years. And I've spoken with them, I've been with them, I've researched this. Also, the trauma of when you've been trafficked, how you might feel, you know, whether it's Elizabeth Smart or even Patty Hearst, you know, that psychology and that dichotomy woven into a new sort of environment, which would be the 1%, as it's called now, of very, very wealthy people, I think is absolutely feasible. And I think it's a good way to sort of help people understand what happens and what decisions have to be made later. So I think it can be all of those things. You know, we can be more than one thing.
In addition to this book, you write a whole lot of stuff. And I must say, you're a very fine writer in my view.
Thank you.
What are some of the other platforms that your writing is on?
Well, I have a political column called America Interrupted on Substack, which has quite a large following. And I write on the politics of our time. And I started it the day that Kamala Harris started running for president. And I wrote every day until the election, and then I write less often. And I worked on that campaign, so I did some strategy work for it. So I have America Interrupted, and then I'm a film critic, so I have Screen Thoughts on Substack as well. And then I have two other books. One is a memoir called The Letter about my mom and me. And my mother had a complicated life, and it's very short. It's 80 pages, which is the way I think novels might be, and memoirs might be getting shorter rather than longer. And then I work in women's issues. So I did a nonfiction book called Circles of Collaboration. You know, I think the opposite of leader is not follower, but collaborator. And women are naturally collaborators, and men love the follow the leader pyramid structure. Which, by the way, Dan, I would say you like that pyramid as well. And so I think that as we start to become more powerful and more financially independent, collaboration could maybe overtake leadership, and maybe we would all be better off for it. So those are some of the things I've written. But I love writing. I've been writing a journal since I was 7. And, you know, I have books and books of them. So I like writing.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and where you were raised and got interested in writing.
We moved 15 times by the time I was 16. So I don't know where I was raised, but my father was at Ford Motor Company and he was in the C-suite at Ford Motor Company. So I traveled in very big circles back then. And then I went to St. Martin, where my dad was overseeing a resort with Henry Ford and a bunch of other people. And then I went to the University of Nebraska because they had the best cheerleading squad and football team, which of course is why one should pick a school, right? And then I really learned a lot about Midwestern mentality and culture and amazing community and family. And then I came to New York City, and that's where I had a daughter who's down in Washington. And I've had an amazingly privileged life, and I've been very, very lucky. So I've been able to experience whatever my curiosity wanted to go to. So and when I look back, I think there's a moment of gratefulness to recognize that A, I could give back, which my father taught me and my grandfather taught me, and B, I could really explore any avenue that was of interest. So I've been lucky.
What would you say is the most interesting of all the interesting things
that I've done?
That you've done or that you're actually interested in?
Oh, interesting. Well, I've been looking a lot at trees lately. I moved to Maine during COVID and I sort of hibernated there for 5 years. And I started walking my dog and like amidst all these amazing trees. And then all of a sudden I turned off my earphones when I was walking. And then all of a sudden the trees, I could feel this energy or whatever. And then I started researching. For example, Dan, did you know that when a tree dies, the other trees reach their roots out to that tree and they keep it standing because they don't want to lose a member of their community?
Not interesting.
Okay, yeah. And if you stand in your yard and you hug a tree barefoot, the science is that they can actually measure the amount of energy the tree puts inside of you. And I started doing that thinking, really? I mean, let's get serious, right? I could tell the one I was traveling and didn't hug the tree that it was definitely different. So I didn't realize that a tree had communities, but also if you're a total bitch, and you're in the forest, the trees will actually recoil physically from it. So I don't know. That's something I've been studying now for a year. And I think that's it. And in terms of interesting people, I've had the opportunity to meet people before they were somebody. And that sort of makes them much more interesting than after they become what we call somebody. I don't really think of it as somebody anymore, but and I've been lucky to have worked on some amazing campaigns and politically, and I've had some amazing CEO opportunities to learn from. And I would say that Gus Levy started Goldman Sachs. He was the managing partner way, way, way back when. And he was an investor in my dad's hotel. And I was sort of Julie of the Love Boat. And he would come into the hotel and he didn't want to hang out at the beach because that's not who he was while his family was there for Christmas. So he would sit in my office and wait for telexes to come back and forth. There was no phone service to St. Martin back then. And he would sit there and he would teach me things and he would criticize me and he would yell at me and he would say, why did you say that? That's the stupidest thing you ever. I mean, he taught me that if a memo is longer than one page, you don't know what you're talking about. He taught me things that helped me in my professional life be much better than those around me. So I would say that's an interesting person I could bring up.
What's another one?
I guess Henry Ford. Henry Ford was going with my father once to 21 Club. They were having a luncheon meeting. And he got out of the car and he looked at the doorman at 21, which at that point, the doorman would open the door and let everybody go in. And he turned to my father and he goes, I wonder what it's like to be doorman at 21. And my dad's like, I don't know, Henry. You know, we called him HF2. So come on, we got to go in. And Mr. Ford turned to him and said, you go in. And he gave the doorman $500 and he put his coat on and his hat on. And for the next hour, he opened doors and let people in and out of their cars because he wanted to know what it was like. I mean, those are the kinds of things I've had the opportunity to observe or to, you know, be part of that sort of show me, okay, pay attention, you know.
You have podcasts yourself, several, I believe.
I do, yes. I have a couple of podcasts. My Screen Thoughts podcast is probably my biggest one, where I've been reviewing films for the last 15 years. I had a partner in it who was much smarter than me, and she actually had done some documentaries, award-winning documentaries. Unfortunately, she died of breast cancer 5 years ago, so I've cut way back. I haven't been able to find a partner I'm sort of clever and quick, but I don't have the knowledge base that you need to be really critical. I've tried to work on that. So I love film. I love streaming. I like it better than people. So I'm much happier to be inside a film than in a dinner party. And so Screen Thoughts is probably my most successful podcast, but I also podcast around women. I have something called You Should Know Her Name, and I don't spend a lot of time on it. So it's occasionally done where I interview women authors sometimes and things like that. So yeah, I have a couple of podcasts that are successful.
I think you do four of them. Is that correct?
I do four, but I also manage some bigger name podcasts. I'm in the podcasting world a lot, but I believe that, you know, here's a strategic moment. Podcasting is now going to morph into YouTube. YouTube is the biggest podcasting platform in the world. And people don't really recognize that yet, but they will, because we started out loving podcasts because you could do it while you're walking or while you were driving or whatever. And, you know, multitasking, as we think we're so good at. Okay, but now people want both. So they want to be able to glance down and look at the conversation that they're being privy to now. So I think podcasting is going to be morphed into a video platform much more than podcasting. So I think it's going to change in this particular year, in 2026.
I was reading the other day about some people who are, they go online and they get subscribers who are interested in receiving stuff by mail. And they are very successful with this.
Are you talking about Substack?
It's something new. It was in the Wall Street Journal the other day.
Oh, I'm not sure what you're referring to, so I couldn't comment on it.
Well, I'll tell you about it a little bit. What they do is mail out letters, physical letters to people.
Oh, yes. And by the way, I just sent to my client base, we're pulling money away from advertising on social media, which I think is going to definitely change. Number one, the credibility level is zero there. So it's already changed. And we call it snail mail, but we're doing many, many mailings. But also, I send out a letter every month to my client base, as well as my what I consider to be my precious list, I should say. And it's an actual snail mail letter, and it might have something else in it. So, for example, last month it was about let your world become smaller, and this is why. And I put a little small squeeze ball that's was plastic, which into the book. The reason I did it is, I don't know if you remember, but Faith Popcorn back in the 80s, 90s, people paid her like $20,000 a month, CEOs from major companies, and she would send them a box once a month. Like one month in the box was a shark. It was a plastic shark. That's all that was in the box that they paid all this money for. And her message in that was, sharks are going to be taking off. You're going to be seeing them everywhere. And she would then correlate that to a message in terms of strategic direction. She was brilliant. I don't know why she stopped it. I loved it. I mean, I didn't get one, but I talked to people who did, and they would tell me what was in them. And that's my reason for doing it. So, you know, letters were always how we confirmed history. So history was confirmed through letters. Okay, what was going to be emails with 8 billion emails going out a day? We're going to confirm history through emails and everybody's lying. I mean, what's the next confirmation? I love that. Yes, it's very much moving back into the central stream.
Let's talk more about the book. We have a couple of minutes left. How is this a preview to the other two?
There are three protagonists in Starling. And what I've noticed is, as women are coming out more in fiction and on film, they're either good or bad. And I think people can be more than one thing. Like, some days I consider really good, and some days I really shouldn't know me. I would prefer not to. So it is three books. The first one is about Justine, who's this woman who's treading water in the Hamptons, wealthy, playing tennis. And then she's asked to go to Saudi Arabia to try to find her billionaire friend's missing daughter. The daughter is Caroline, who was trafficked from the time she was 17. And so the second book is Caroline's story. And then the third book is the trafficker story. And the trafficker was a woman who something happened to, and she became filled with revenge and rage, and she trafficked women. And she basically would pick women who had done horrible things to her. So it's the three stories, how they interweave, but how each of them comes to grips with who they are and what they became, et cetera. So I crafted it that way because after I finished the first book, people in the book clubs and stuff that, you know, we just came out, but I've done a lot of book clubs and happy to do more if anybody's doing a book club. And I recognized that the questions were more about Caroline and Ava than they were about Justine, because Justine's, you get who she is. You know, it's all about her version of what's happening. And then people said, well, I need more. I need more. So I did it for that reason. But the second reason I did it is we are in talks, and I would love to have this be, you know, if this were a Netflix series, you want three seasons, you know, so, and they do. So this also gives those three seasons. But I loved the story as it unfolded, and I've learned so much more about Caroline and Ava after I started writing the second two books. So that's why it's a trilogy.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast. Book is The Flight of the Starling. And I'm talking to Chris Mercer, the author. And I'll see you soon. And thanks again.
Thanks again. Thanks again, Dan. Big hug to Chris.
I will. Bye-bye.